This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the first of what promises to be an annual report on the state of the news media, the Project for Excellence in Journalism finds little to celebrate, at least in mainstream media. America's newspapers and magazines, our broadcast and cable outlets, offer less serious reporting by smaller staffs, which make more mistakes, and not surprisingly, the report concludes that audiences and trust are both down. The study is the work of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, an institute affiliated with Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and it was funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. Later on in the program, NPR's health correspondent Julie Rovner will join us to talk about a story in today's New York Times about what the Bush administration calls video news releases, in which people pose as reporters to promote the new Medicare law. But first, competition, consolidation, market fragmentation, technological change, and public attitudes in journalism. What do you want from journalism? Information, entertainment, objectivity, attitude, complexity, certainty. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, Tom Rosensteel. And good to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil.
So why did your organization decide to publish an annual report?
Well, actually, the idea was not ours, but our funders came up with this because we have done research for now 7 years into different media at different times, how the press covers different events, and it took people outside journalism to say, you know, what does it all add up to? What's going on generally? I mean, you point out strengths and weaknesses with this story or that story, but is the press getting better? Is it getting worse? Why are we seeing what we're seeing? Give us a more holistic sense of things.
How far back did you go?
Well, we did two things. First, we gathered all the public information or scholarly data that was that we could lay our hands on that was already available. And some of that goes back 40 or 50 years in the case of newspapers, and in the case of online, it goes back 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a content analysis of what are we getting in the last year from these various media. And we studied 8 media sectors, and for each of them we looked at what's going on with content, what's going on with audience, what's going on with economics, ownership, public attitudes, and investment in the newsroom. We tried to look at those same 6 issues across all of the media sectors.
And one of the big conclusions you come to is that, whether it's cause and effect, I'm not sure, but shrinking audience, at least for mainstream media, is a huge part of this.
Yes, and some of this is technological, I think, that, you know, we were once in a world with 4 TV stations or channels per city, and now we've got 100 or 150. When that happens, most of those channels have a smaller piece of the pie. Certainly the original 4 have a smaller piece of the pie than they used to have. Network TV news audiences for nightly news have dropped 49% since 1980, 34% since 1990. It's not a surprise, then, that we see a decline in the number of people who work in the news divisions. Mm-hmm. The number of correspondents in network TV is down by a third. I'm not sure you can really blame the people who run the networks if they've seen that much audience hemorrhage. But there is, then you begin to wonder about a chicken and egg effect. Are the audiences continuing to leave because they see the product changing in a way they dislike? Or is this inevitable and it makes no sense to sort of hold the line and try and reinvest in that in your correspondent corps?
Well, one big technological change, and certainly the last 15 years would cover most of its life, would be the growth of cable news outlets, CNN, Fox now, MSNBC, CNBC. Are these growth industries? Are their audiences building?
They have certainly grown over a 7-year span. If you look back to 1996, when we saw the launch of of MSNBC and Fox, CNN has been around since 1980. But in the last 2 years, since the end of 2001, we've really seen a kind of leveling, a plateau. The median audience for these stations overall, the 3 of them, mm-hmm. Hasn't really grown. There was a giant spike during the Iraqi war. What they offer, and I think the reason for their growth over the longer period, is we live in an on-demand culture. People want whatever they want when they want it. And cable offers that. If you have to wait till 6:30 at night to watch the network nightly news, it's just a lot more convenient to turn on cable right now. But the internet offers a challenge to cable, I think, in that we're beginning to see ABC News posting stories as soon as they're ready on their website. As that kind of thing evolves, you may have television news on demand, and I don't have to wait through the story that they happen to be running. I can, like I can on a website, go to exactly the story I want to see when I want to see it. Only we're talking television here now, not just text.
Mm-hmm. All of you, of course, are media observers yourselves. You're listening to radio right now, one of the media that Tom Rosenstiel looks at in his report. We'd like you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Mary, who's on the line with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that one of the things I think that journalism has come to, especially like the nightly news, is that all the stories are based on how much they can fear the, you know, make us more scared. And I really don't appreciate that. Instead of getting a full news story, it just seems like there's such a fear content. And, you know, I don't know how we're ever going to get to a peaceful situation in the world when, you know, they want to scare us about what to eat, what to think, you know, and what other countries are possibly going to do to us. And I really don't appreciate that.
Tom Rosenstiel, does your content analysis bear that out?
Well, it's hard to pin that down with data, but it is true that I think two things are intersecting here. One is that there's a sort of progressive tradition in journalism, which is to be a watchdog and to alert people to things that they need to be wary of. And as you've had this pressure on audiences, you do have a sort of boy cry wolf syndrome that can occur in at some news organizations, where they will sort of do dirty hotel sheets, stinky or bacteria in your yogurt, killer iced tea, killer bras. These are all actual stories I'm mentioning, by the way. There's a tendency to sort of, in the short run, scare people to get them to watch, and
but
that's been documented.
I also think in the broader sense, just the whole terrorism thing, too, it has just gotten so out of hand, you know, on a broader global scale. Instead of talking about ways that or having stories about things that are happening, you know, between countries that are good or positive or peaceful, it really has such a negative content. And even like, I mean, I don't know if you saw Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine, but that's, he was saying that just the difference between U.S. media and Canadian media, and, you know, Canadians don't lock their doors, for instance.
It's hard to know, I think, what, you know, whether the press creates that fear or whether the fear creates the coverage of it. But it's true that, as Mary says, the percentage of Americans who believe that the press is sort of motivated out of financial motive and is running pictures to sensationalize and scare people to attract an audience and not out of a sense of public interest, that is growing and has been growing fairly steadily over 15 years. So there are a lot of people who agree with Mary about this.
Mary, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right,
let's go now to Patrick, and Patrick's with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Yeah, I said to the screen caller that the thing I wanted to talk about was the blurring between news and especially on the 24-hour cable channels, news and commentary. But one of the things that I thought of that really frustrates me as I was waiting was listening to reports from reporters at the White House. It is almost like they are giving us press releases as opposed to reporting. I mean, there is no skepticism at all when they report something that is coming from the White House, and it just blows me away. It's like you almost want to write in and say, hey, are you collecting part of your check from the White House as well as from whatever network you happen to be working from? I mean, there is no skepticism in many of these journalists anymore.
You're talking particularly about the cable outlets?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tom Rosensteel?
Well, what we found in the analysis of cable, in the content analysis, is something that I think makes a certain amount of sense. If you're on all the time, the irony is you actually have less time to report because you're ready to go on the air. There's a piece in USA Today about the reporting with Jonathan Carl, who moved from CNN to ABC, describes how when he was on CNN, he would be on the air and his cell phone would ring, and he knew it was sources calling him back, but he never had any time to take those phone calls because he was on the air reporting. There is a less density to the stories on cable. There are fewer sources per story. There are actually fewer stories in the sense of written, edited packages on cable. Most of the storytelling on cable is done through live reporter stand-ups or live interviews. It's extemporaneous reporting. And when you have that, you have less time to write and edit and verify and check and get a second point of view. So it's much easier, in effect, for the sources to kind of control the story, throw it at you. You have to instantly go out there and recite or relate what you've heard.
But does that do a service to the American public if, in essence, we are not getting the full story? We're getting why not even bother with reporters at the White House? Why not just take their news releases ad hoc and say, this is it? And,
stay tuned, Patrick. We'll have a story about that later in the program.
I would add one thing to what Patrick said, and that is we found that there are clearly four distinct parts to the cable programming day. And the evening part, which is during prime time and is competing with entertainment programming on other channels, is essentially talk radio on television. These shows really are different than what you get during the daytime when you've got the kind of news desk and the wire service copy flowing through. Shows like O'Reilly or Larry King are more host-centric talk shows built around the personalities of the host, interviewing personalities or debating an issue.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Tom, I wondered, he was talking about the line between news and commentary, and you were just discussing that, but it seems to me one of the things your report talks to a lot is the blurring of the line between information and entertainment.
Yes, and there are a lot of reasons for that. If most of these people that have fled to these other channels have fled from news to entertainment, one of the things that some stations or channels or outlets in print and broadcast have done is to become lighter, to become more infotainment oriented, to try and lure some of those people who are bleeding away back. If you look at Time and Newsweek, for instance, less so U.S. News, they have more pages than they used to have 20 years ago, but they have fewer pages of what we'd consider traditional hard news and many more pages of celebrity and entertainment news, news you can use, lifestyle news. And if you sort of look at that changing spectrum on the TV dial, of course, you could get your news from E! Entertainment Network or Comedy Central, or you'd never have to go look at one of those fuddy-duddies on NPR ever again.
We'll be talking more about market fragmentation when we get back, something that happened in radio many years ago where instead of having a general radio station that serviced any number of audiences, you have very carefully denoted demographics groups for which each radio station's format is seeking to attract, though there seem to be lots of different classic rock demographics that they all seem to be going after. Don't ask me why. We'll be talking more with Tom Rosensteel, the director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, after we get back from a break. And again, we'd like you to join us with your questions. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the state of journalism in this country. Our guest is Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@npr.org. And next caller is Bob, who's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Just a quick comment and a question. I've found myself getting more and more of my straight news from the Internet. About 2 years ago, I would not have thought that that would be likely. But as I started looking through some of the weblogs, I find that they do a better job, including linking to a lot of other articles in print. And I was just wondering, my question is, is there any sort of data on how many people are getting their information, their journalism from the Internet?
I'm going to blank on the statistic that we cite in the report, but in September 2003, I think it was 150 million Americans who went online that month. And the survey suggests that roughly half of those who go online get news there each week, at least once a week. So you're talking about a significant number, 70 million Americans who get some of their news online. And it has all the advantages that people want now, which is getting what you want when you want it, targeting exactly the kind of news you want, the style of news you want, and if you're distrustful of the press, as a growing number of Americans are, being able to sort of balance that, getting alternative views, or if you don't trust journalists at all, just going to bloggers and chat rooms and getting what you want in the manner and style in which you prefer it. It is going to be the platform, I think, where in a very short period of time, the majority of Americans are going to get a lot of their news.
Oh, I think that's a good thing, because I've been following news pretty seriously since Nixon was elected in '68. I'm old enough for that. And I've never been a media basher of any kind, but I've just found lately, past few years, maybe since this administration's been in power, that as a previous caller mentioned about the Washington Press Corps, they seem to they've been a little bit feistier lately, I think, with McClellan. But previous to that, they seem to take their talking points right from the White House, and that's just one area. What I like about the Internet is you can link around and find, and not just things that you agree with. I go to left sites and right sites. There's good left-wing sites like Atrios and the Smirking Chimp, and there's good ones on the right like Tacitus and the Volokh Conspiracy. And you can get a lot of information, and they link to printed articles, and there's a lot of good discussion. I just find it to be the best way anymore, better than than subscribing to magazines, other than listening to NPR. That's the other the other way that I get my news.
Well, I think what you
thanks
get...
for the kind words, Bob.
I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I think what you get in the Internet is precisely the sort of dialectic that we have when we look at journalism generally. The Internet gives you the ability to go deep and get what you want. It also increases the amount of rumor and gossip and innuendo that you may be receiving. It's harder to know whether what you get there is accurate or not. You need to know the brand and the source of the information. Mm-hmm. And the notion that we all live in or all have a common understanding and common public square is eroded as the hegemony of a few news organizations erodes.
One thing, Bob, and thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
One thing that Bob talks about is obviously national news is available on the Internet. You can also get international links if you think Libération or The Guardian is the greatest newspaper ever printed, and links to all of that. But they're not likely to cover your city council meeting or your county elections.
Yeah, and this is really huge. Radio, which was once a largely local medium with, national updates at the hour, has converted from into a largely national medium. We said at the beginning that that most news organizations are losing audience. The exception to that, one of the big exceptions, is National Public Radio, whose audience has more than doubled in the last 10 years. It's because of the vanishing amount of news on radio that's local that has helped, that's one of the factors that's helped NPR. we talk about the internet as this wonderful source.
Before we leave that, though, yeah. I mean, the FCC change, which said you no longer have to carry newscasts, at least that was the interpretation. A lot mm-hmm. of people jumped on it, meant that a lot of radio stations stopped carrying newscasts. But the loss, you point to a large number of staff members lost in news departments in radio stations, which is, in some respects, was shocking. But a lot of those were, you know, hourly newscasters who were Rip Reed at the editor's desk. I'm not sure, was that a loss to journalism, if, you know, hourly capsules of news?
Well, they're getting those hourly capsules now through syndication.
When they bother to run them at all.
And, yeah, and although we did find that most of these stations do run some mm-hmm. sort of news. Now, it may be, you know, pretty limited, but it's still a source of accidental news consumption for a lot of Americans. But what was true of those local news departments is they might have one person who was a reporter out on the street. They might do that public affairs show every Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm.
They had a news department, and while there was a lot of rip and read, there was some local content, and that, to a large extent, is gone. In the last 2 years, what we found was that the number of news people in a station that has a news department has actually increased, but that's because the average news department now is providing news to four stations.
Let's get another caller in. Nathan joins us from Reno, Nevada.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an aspiring reporter, and I'd like to find out your comments on the relationship of media consolidation to content. After the 1996 Telecom Act allowed a few corporations to buy up many of the radio stations, we've apparently lost 10,000 media workers in the radio industry, and we're losing the fight to keep this from happening in other media. In my view, this means fewer reporters and less journalistic freedom with more corporate control of content. I'm curious what your content analysis says about this.
Don?
Well, there's clearly a concentration of ownership. We now have the top 20 newspaper companies control roughly 70% of the roughly 70% of the daily circulation of newspapers, and that pattern is repeated across media. We have more outlets for news actually owned by fewer corporations. Now, that's happening for a reason. If each outlet is having has a smaller share of the pie, one way for corporations to sort of reassemble the audience for advertisers is to buy more outlets, so that they've got the same audience that they can deliver to advertisers, but they've got them across a lot of platforms. The question is, what's the impact for the consumer? Well, it potentially could be a better thing if they create a kind of giant omnibus news organization with lots of reporters who are covering the world in the same way that CBS News once covered the world. But it's not necessarily going to happen that way. It could be that they're producing relatively small-size news organizations, just simply spreading that product out over many, many platforms. Because there's economies of scale, and it's just profitable to do it that way, and they're not really investing in a better product. I think there's evidence on both sides. Some places are going toward investment, and others are not.
Go ahead, Nathan.
Did your report get into the content in terms of corporate control of content? Because I was talking to Linda Foley of the National Newspaper Guild, and she says it's a horrible time to be a journalist in newspaper because of the corporate control and the loss of jobs.
Well, it's pretty hard to determine whether corporate ownership is dictating story selection. There's a sort of cause and effect issue that's pretty hard to pin down. I worked for some big corporations in my journalistic career, and I certainly never had any idea what the chairman of the board wanted me to cover. But there is a more sort of subtle impact of who gets promoted and who gets to be the boss over time, and what do those bosses want to see in the paper or on the broadcast. But pinning down, you know, taste and judgment and attributing that to, stock price or even corporate ownership, it's a hard thing to do.
Nathan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
One question, though, is the Internet, which you pointed to as an exception in many other respects. Is this consolidation? I mean, it would seem antithetical even to the idea of the Internet.
And yet the top 20 websites that deliver news and information are all owned by the very largest corporations in the country. In part, that's because people moving to the Internet are gravitating to old traditional brands. So mm-hmm. The New York Times and CNN and Washington Post and USA Today are all major websites. It's also because to deliver the kind of news that attracts a large audience requires a big investment. You need a lot of people. You need a lot of stuff there. What you have at the same time, though, is a sort of a second Internet, the world of bloggers, the world of citizen journalists, which are, I think, emerging as a kind of opinion press in the same way that The Nation or the New Republic or the National Review don't really have huge circulation, maybe 100,000 mm-hmm. people buy those publications, but their influence on the rest of the media is much greater. I think that's the role that bloggers will play, only here it really is a much more varied world than even The Nation and the
American
National
Standard
Review.
And the American Prospect.
Yeah, you can mention a dozen publications right. Where we're talking about 100,000 active bloggers.
Mm-hmm. Alternate media, you say, is growing, and another big area of growth, ethnic media.
Yes. If we had done this report 10 years ago, I think we would have said, you know, it's not clear that young people are gravitating to journalism, and it's not clear whether people will read in the future. Well, the growth areas beyond the Internet that we found were ethnic press, including newspapers, and alternative weeklies. English language newspaper circulation has dropped by 11% since 1990. Spanish language newspaper circulation has quadrupled to 1.7 million since 1990. So people are leaving in some way English language newspapers, and other people, and in some cases the same people, are moving over to Spanish language newspaper. Alternative weeklies, the same thing. Growth in the number of weeklies and growth in the circulation.
And specifically, what do you mean by alternative?
Alternative weeklies would be
Voice?
The alternative weekly in your town, like the Village Voice or the Washington City Paper, or the there is one and sometimes two in most major cities. Now these provide targeted content. You can. It's not a full service newspaper providing everything. It's targeted to entertainment news and lifestyle news in the case of alternative weeklies. Spanish language press has obviously got a cultural orientation that's both covering events overseas that may not be covered in English press, and also covering cultural events in your town that may not be covered in the local English language press.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Terry. Terry's with us from Salt Lake City.
Hello, Neil. Thank you for taking my call. I've been in broadcast journalism for 35 years, both at the national network level and at the local level. I'm at the local level now. I wanted to refute primarily the caller who mentioned earlier that we like to sit around and choose our stories based on what scares people. There could be nothing further from the truth in that. The fact of the matter is that much of news is what is a problem in society. If we didn't tell the listener or the reader what goes on, what is a problem they're facing, they'd never know of such things, such as DDT or the dangers of radiation or thalidomide or many of the other problems they face. We've also done focus groups on what people want to see in their local news. Just recently, we got research back at the station I work at that says 78% of the people want to see stories of consumer dangers, of how they can protect their family from crime, what are the problems facing society today. They want these type of stories. We have families there, too. We're not trying to scare people because we don't want to scare our own kids and our own wives. So that concept is really just so far off base. And as one of your guests said, it is something that many people believe. And it's a shame. It's one of the things that sadden us as journalists, that people out there feel we're just trying to scare them. Nothing could be further from the truth, Neil.
We're talking about an annual report published today by the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Our guest is Tom Rosensteel. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And a response to Terry's question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most journalists would agree with Terry completely that they feel that they're choosing these stories for public service. There is, you know, he mentions the focus group research, and there are some stations I think that may have pandered to that in the way in the language they use. There are certain language that's been tested: shocking, stunning, startling. And you'll see those words a lot in some broadcast venues. But I think that the issue, as Terry says, is this disconnect that the public increasingly suspects that we're doing these things for motives that are very different than what journalists think they're doing. And that's a real problem. It sort of gets to the crux of the issue. Somehow, people no longer believe that journalists are motivated by public interest. And this is we need to reconnect our sense of trust with people.
It's not up to the journalists to market themselves or to promote a public image. It is true that we are dedicated. Good journalists are dedicated to serving the public. Those of us who live by the Sigma Delta Chi code of ethics and keep it on our desks each day, such as I do.
Yeah, but Terry, there's an impression that local news in particular, local TV news, I should say, in particular, tends to, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. If it's on fire, it's going to be on the lead of the program. And there have been studies done that while the incidence of crime in most American cities has been dropping the last several years consistently, people are more afraid than ever of crime.
Yes, and I think that was true especially 10 years ago when they were finding out the bleed that leads was a big winner in ratings, but also the public's getting sick of that now to a large degree. And what we're finding in our focus groups is, yes, they want information, they want it balanced, they want it fair. They don't necessarily need to see every auto wreck and every shooting on the news that happened unless it directly affects their family. And I think the responsible news organizations are trying to pull back from that crime lead mentality, and let the public know, yes, here's a true danger, whether it's radiation or testing in the West Desert of Utah, that type of information, or a consumer product mm-hmm. that may be flammable or harmful to your child, as opposed to what gang member shot what other gang member in the street corner overnight.
Okay, Terry, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil, for your balanced program, too. And I must tell you, as a journalist, you've got, and NPR does have, one of the finest news organizations in the country. And I wish they were all as fair and balanced as you are.
That's a phrase that rings out through journalism on almost every outlet. Terry, thanks very much. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Neil.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Tom Rosensteel. He's director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And joining us will be NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, who will talk about a story that was published in today's New York Times. The Bush administration is producing video news releases with people who are posing as reporters, producing little news packages for distribution on your local TV news outlets to promote the new Medicare law. So we'll be talking about that after we come back from a break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.